How does the literal city of Seoul feed your soul, feed your stomach, and influence your heart and mind? This is the story of the K wave. Let it wash over you here on Seemingly Unrelated. Welcome back to another enchanted evening with your friends at Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast where we connect seemingly unrelated elements of politics, society, culture, and history all together as we explore the webs of life's little murder boards to inspire intellectual curiosity and combat the prevalence of misinformation. I am one of your hosts. I am Jason Heat, and I am a creative in the worlds of podcasting, film, performing arts, and professional wrestling. As always, we are joined by the captain of the good ship Unrelated. He is a professor of digital humanities at King's College in London, Professor Dr. Mr. Sir Andrew Johnstone.
That's still true. Yes. Ahoy there, and welcome to... I thought you were going to say the good ship Unreliable. I just want you to know.
Well, I didn't, but next time I will. Of course, what's a podcast without a producer, an editor, and a Gen Z ambassador? She's also a DJ. She's probably your favorite cast member, Naomi.
Oh, thank you. I hope I'm your favorite cast member.
Hashtag Naomi.
But what I need is intellectual adventure, and the kind that only Dr., Mr., Professor, Sir can offer. So, Captain, my Captain, where do you take the audio waves today?
You know, this is going to be another episode, I think, where Naomi is going to know a lot more than Jason does. Having listened to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles episode many times during the editing recently,
which you can listen to exclusively on our Patreon.
I feel like a lot of the topics recently have been things I know nothing about, so I'm really excited.
You're pumped for today. Yeah. Jason, what's your relationship with K-pop?
It plays when I go get Korean barbecue. I don't understand what's happening most of the time, but to be fair, I'm meat drunk 50% of the way in.
You say meat truck or meat drunk?
Meat drunk. I am not okay, a meat. I mean, meat I am. Truck. I'm also a meat truck. I am an unfortunately large sized man, but I also at that point am meat drunk.
Yeah, I do also love that your song where you were singing about what you know about K-pop is still like an early 2000s, not quite emo, but not quite pop. Like
it's music. It's just musical theater.
It's the music in your heart.
Yeah, it's what I was trying. It's not K-pop.
No, it's not K-pop, but you know K-pop, right? It's out there. It's huge. It is Gen Z's, and this is why Naomi's going to know a lot more than you. Number one thing, right? Like when people think it's about Gen Z.
I more think of it as Korea's number one thing more than a generation. I think of K-pop as being Korean pop music.
You would agree that in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe a little bit longer, it has grown to an unexpected popularity amongst the global audience.
Well, in all honesty, I actually thought that it hit its peak several years ago, and I would have thought that it's starting to fade a little bit. Not fade, but like settle back down. There was a period of time where I forget, like there was at least one significant like number one K-pop artist or band a few years ago that was so popular that they had like sodas in the jungle gyms, crazy ass amazing amusement park level grocery store that I went to, and this had to be like 4 years ago. I feel like that was kind of a peak.
Well, I don't know. I love TikTok. I don't even like K-pop, and I know a lot about K-pop by accident because of TikTok. And like Jennie like a new artist? And
new question mark.
Well,
yeah.
She was in like Black.
She was in Blackpink. That's correct.
Like, why do I know this? I shouldn't know this. I don't listen to any of the music. And she's really big. Just like headline Coachella or really big in Coachella. Yeah, it is big still, I'd say.
It's big. And I mean, there was a bit of controversy last year when the K-pop performer, I believe it was Jennie, was headlining at Glastonbury. Was like one of the nights on the big stage, and there was some old I don't know, racist white people who are angry that K-pop was dominating. You're like, what are you talking about? It's Glastonbury. So if you don't know, everyone, what is K-pop? Of course, the K in K-pop is short for Korean pop music. But it is its own distinct genre in a lot of ways. So the sort of textbook definition of K-pop is that it is a fusion of 1980s new wave synth sounds with R&B/hip-hop rhythms and an undercurrent of Korean folk music syncopation and narrative themes coupled with a visual aesthetic that is loud, energetic, and features very precise and complicated choreography. That is the technical definition of K-pop.
In some ways, the aesthetic and the choreography is what closely brands it to what we would consider pop music more than its musical stylings.
Oh, I 100% agree. And I would even say the aesthetic is more important than the music itself. Yeah. But I mean, the popularity of K-pop is surely attached to, as Naomi has rightly pointed out, TikTok and how there are fun dances that you can also do poorly, potentially, depending on how old you are. You want to guess how many billions of dollars the K-pop industry is worth?
Many. Many billions. I have no idea.
80 billion dollars. And in 2023, 35 K-pop albums entered the Billboard's top 200 in the United States. So, when then, Jason, when do you think the first Korean musical group to get real international notice was? What era, roughly, do you think this happened?
I don't know. I'm hoping you're not going to say that it was Gangnam Style by Psy.
Well, no, that is not the first Korean group to get a lot of notice in the United States. No, the first ever Korean musical group to get international notice, mostly in the States, but also Canada and the UK, was the Kim Sisters, who debuted on the Ed Sullivan Show in September of 1959.
I don't know them at all, actually.
No, you don't know them at all because a lot of reasons. No, they did 22 performances on the Ed Sullivan Show. They were on the Merv Griffin Show all through the 1960s, from 1959 until their final performance in 1970.
And they were just called the Kim Sisters?
The Sisters, the three sisters whose last names were Kim. They were, two of them were actually sisters. One of them was adopted after her parents died in the war, in the Korean, what we call the Korean War, what was called the Korean Civil War in Korea. And she was adopted into this family. And they exclusively performed covers of popular rhythm and blues songs in English, like Charlie Brown and stuff like that, blues and jazz and what have you, despite the fact that two of them did not, until the mid-60s, speak English. So they did it fully phonetically. They just learned the sounds to make, which is fascinating.
That is part of the reason why the Police song D-Do-Do-Da-D-Da-Da-Da is actually one of the most successful songs around the world. It's the song that goes, D-Da-Da, it's all I want to say to you. But it's like nonsense gibberish words. And because it doesn't mean anything in any language, it is catchy in all languages and became a hit internationally and was one of the most popular international songs ever because you didn't need to know what the words were.
So, yes, that's super common that songs would be hits even though nobody understands what the lyrics are because they're just fun to dance to. But the Kim Sisters are a product of a very specific 1950s and 1960s, I don't know what you want to call it, entertainment enterprise known commonly as the, quote, China Doll Review, a traveling show billed as, quote, 20 of the most beautiful Oriental showgirls ever assembled on stage direct from South Korea, Honolulu, Hong Kong, and Macau. Basically, Jason.
Yes.
Everywhere the United States military went, in their wake around their bases would crop up a industry of young women who would perform as musical acts to try and, like, make ends meet while they are in the middle of an occupation. And the GIs, you had a bunch of men, there's no women, like, they're not serving. They're serving in sex segregated units. So there's like no women in general around for them. So there's a demand for some engagement with women. And yeah, there's plenty of locals who want to do some performance, some singing, some dancing.
Is this the beginning of the American male sexual exotification fetishization of Asian women specifically? Like, did that happen before, or is it specifically the army in these sort of South Pacific theaters of combat and then those stories being passed on that actually creates this sort of trope that has stayed fairly consistently, I think, in the United States sort of sexuality for a long time? I don't know if I'm saying that right, and I apologize if I'm not, but like,
yeah, the next line in my note to my script is, this is one of the foundational trends in establishing the trope of the submissive East Asian woman and the objectification of Asian women as doll-like in their appearance and fragility.
There you go.
Yeah, that's really, like, the Kim sisters are these, like, small, waifish East Asian women who, yeah, they fit, like, they wear the sort of the silk Chinese dress, like, that's very form-fitting, that has no sleeves and sort of a high collared neck, or they might even be in kimonos in one of their performances, all sorts of things. That comes from the women who were trying to, you know, make a living in an occupation. There's actually a great Japanese movie, I think Ozu is the director, from 1949, called When a Woman Ascends the Stairs. Great title for a movie. That's all about a woman who ends up running a brothel because she has to survive in Tokyo during the occupation. And it's filmed in Tokyo during the occupation, which is a very intense time to be filming a movie. But that's what's happening. And you're right, that image then comes back with those GIs, because the only women they encountered were the ones who were specifically catering to them.
Right.
And like, you know,
and they're telling those stories, and that's influencing media, and it's influencing desire. And
yeah, exactly. So the Kim sisters would again appear on Ed Sullivan 22 times. But what's critical to the Kim sisters is they were built upon an aesthetic, right?
Yes.
They're talented. They're good singers, but they're not writing songs. They're not doing particularly like ambitious covers of these songs. They're just kind of playing what people were familiar with, and then presenting it in a package that was a little bit different, a little bit more interesting, aesthetically changed. The musical roots of K-pop, where we get the sound of K-pop, is universally agreed. This is a weird situation. There's one person who kind of invented this, which is crazy, which is So Taiji. Sorry, I did my best. Don't know Korean that great. But a lot of people think his name is Seo, and I looked it up. Nope, it is So Taiji. We're just going to call him So for now. Young man from Seoul, the city of Seoul, who in the 1980s and 90s, he struggled to fit in with his musical contemporaries. He just didn't think that his sounds and ideas really meshed with what people were doing. He couldn't quite find what he wanted. And then one day, digging around in a music store, he discovered MIDI. Do you remember MIDI, Jason? Do you know what MIDI is?
I mean, I remember downloading MIDI files from my computer and listening to, again, MIDI representations of the MASH and Babylon 5 theme song, which is like the way that I used the internet in the late 90s is coming up over and over again. And it really centers around a few very specific TV shows and me getting audio content of it. But yeah, I had a bunch of MIDI files of different TV tracks.
I love that. Naomi, if I say MIDI, M-I-D-I to you, what do you think?
I think like a MIDI keyboard that you like plug into your laptop to create music.
Yeah. And the nerdiest response, when I think of MIDI, I genuinely think of the proprietary like connection system, like the four-prong circular
plus. Nerd!
And now for something completely unrelated.
Am I the least nerdy in the room then? Because I thought of music production stuff. Tell me I'm not nerdy.
But you, that's pretty nerdy.
It's a
like
different kind of nerdy. It's
yeah,
not...
you're just like a like if we went to a guitar center, I feel like Jason and I would be tapping our toes and pointing at our watches, and you'd be like, "No, I'm just look. I just want to look.
Yeah.
Just looking."
So you're kind of nerdy in the same way that a middle-aged divorced dad is, like wandering around Guitar Center, being like, "Oh, that would be a cool plug-in." So
I give big dad energy. So true.
I must say, we're establishing that Naomi is actually is a DJ who is a middle-aged dad and a party dude. I think Naomi is like a real problem waiting to happen. So Naomi has accurately identified what MIDI really is, which is just a universal system for making sounds connect to a computer, basically. It's just a way of hooking synthesizers up. But he found a MIDI, and so now he could actually create the US-based hip-hop sounds he'd been hearing. There just wasn't a way anywhere he could find to make those sounds. But MIDI, you can do synthetic beats.
Yeah, you can do synthetic renditions of the Cheers theme song.
You can always make the Cheers theme song. So he was like, oh, wow, I can make the beats that I hear on records and are in my head. Now I can do them with this keyboard that will come out as like a synth sound. And he combined that with his own just disdain for the really strict social hierarchy of South Korea. So he formed a band, So Taiji and Boys. There is no the in that. So Taiji and Boys. And they went on a really popular Korean talent show, a bit of like an X Factor show in 1992, and they were last. They were dead last. They did this hip-hop Korean thing, and everyone's like, I don't know what the fuck is going on. But enough people really liked it, and they grew in popularity, you know, through the back channels. People became interested, passing tapes around. And then in 1994, we know they hit it big because there was a panic in the news about them putting satanic messages in their music if you spun their records backwards.
Why is it always... like the sign of making it is satanic panic. It's always satanic.
I love that shit.
Yeah, no, it's always satanic because I don't know, man. People were. It's. I mean, the Moonies are involved, and there's a lot going on in South Korea that like satanic panic would have hit in the 90s, just like in the 80s in the U.S. But they retire in 1996, and this is when. So they're kind of a singular act. But they catch the attention of a man named Lee Ho-yeon, who in 1997 forms the DSP Media Group, which is the first and largest K-pop production company. And he specifically wanted to find talent which emulated So's style of blending hip-hop and pop music into Korean aesthetics. And that all started in 1997 into 1998.
That mirrors sort of almost perfectly the same time that American pop music is turning into boy bands or creating these kind of pop music factories. So is this a case of two similar ideas because the market was ready for it happening separately or in parallel? Or does the American boy band like production factory model follow the K-pop, or the K-pop follows the American?
They are happening in parallel.
Okay.
Whether or not that is because the world was ready for it, or it just happened to be that South Korea and the United States, because in Britain, Naomi, there had been boy bands through much of the early part of the 90s as well. Like that model. You know, there's a whole movie out right now. Better Man is about one of the guys from one of those.
Robbie Williams.
Yeah, Robbie Williams.
Oh, was Robbie Williams? Was Robbie Williams originally a boy band?
Take That. How do you not know about Take That?
Americans do not. People from the United States have no idea who Take That is. That's why that movie didn't.
I was about to say, if people in America knew about Take That, that movie would have been a hit.
What did Take That do again? Was it Let It Shine? That song. Hey, get to know ya. You're the one that matters to me. The one that matters to me. Hey, get to know ya. No?
Yeah, no, I'm into
Crickets.
It. You got to sing last time, Jason. So.
Yeah, but yeah, I sang. I'm not upset at it. I just, there's zero, it does nothing.
Has Mac the Knife been stuck in my head for the last 2 months? Yes. But specifically, Jason's version. So that's all happening in parallel. This is when K-pop is taking storm in Korea and getting its sound. When does it go global? Gangnam Style.
It was Gangnam Style. Okay.
Yeah. Released in July 2012, Gangnam Style was the first single off of Psy's sixth studio album. And the term is a neologism that is referring to the way that people in the neighborhood of Gangnam and Seoul are really these sort of like affluent posers who want to like, you know, they're always trying to show off, but they're trying to be cool about it. And really, they're all dicks. So the whole song, very tongue-in-cheek. So he made a silly dance because the song is meant to be silly. I want to point that out because I think a lot of people are like, haha, Koreans, they're really funny. And they're like, no, no, no. Specifically, Psy is making fun of rich people, which I can get behind. The video for said song, Jason, launched on YouTube the 15th of July, 2012, and became viral almost instantly. YouTube brought Psy's Gangnam Style into the homes of a billion people, apparently, which is insane to think about. And it wasn't for the song. It was for the dance.
Yes, but also I think similar to the doo-doo-da-da, I think that Americans really liked hearing Gangnam Style. Like, I do think the combination of the dance and the catchy catchphrase, they go hand in hand.
They help each other, of course. Yep. Nothing exists in isolation.
It's symbiotic.
But, the UN called Psy an international sensation for his dance specifically. NASA said that Psy's dance moves will live forever in the hearts of millions. NASA, the space agency.
Why did NASA even comment on this?
Good fucking question. That's just how big Psy was. NASA was weighing in.
It's crazy because I just remember people making fun of it. But maybe that's because I was part of the hipster too cool for school club at the time.
You kind of were. I mean, other people were.
I was about to say, we were in the same club, so we were literally.
Yeah, no, I was out there. Listen, I was also making fun of it. But people were genuinely into this, so much so that Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Cameron, tried to do Gangnam Style, and it looked absolutely idiotic. It was the 37th worst thing he did that day.
To be fair, and we've talked about this, there are so many moments in British politics that would be immediately disqualifying for American politicians before the year 2020.
So if we look at the Google Trends, the term K-pop doubles in its search volume in summer 2012. So Psy's Gangnam Style is when K-pop becomes known around the world. But it's not it's continued to grow, right?
No, because Psy's Gangnam Style was a novelty song in the United States. It was not a harbinger of a new musical genre.
I think that's what it was everywhere. It was like just like a funny.
It was Who Let the Dogs Out.
Yeah.
You know, like
It was Crazy Frog.
And now for something completely unrelated.
Crazy Frog. I bet Jason doesn't know what Crazy Frog is.
Let's go Crazy Frog.
The seemingly unrelated this episode is Naomi bringing some obscure ass British.
Is this what you play at the club? Like, is this what?
If you played that at the club, it would go mental. I'm putting that on my USB.
So Gangnam Style, as you know, it's a one-hit wonder. At best. How then does K-pop blow up? All right.
You attach it to the dynamite and then you
wind
push
the clock back to 1997. You're Tony Blair. Put this in your head.
I'm not.
You just won an absolute slam dunk landslide victory because after 18 years of Tory leadership, Britain is doing fine. But everyone was kind of bored of them, and they kind of fucked up this weird monetary policy thing. And everyone was like, we're done with you, John Major. And so Tony Blair becomes the prime minister, and Labour, for the first time since like the mid-70s, is in charge of Britain. Bad news, Jason. It's Britain in 1997. What's the major economic foundation of the British economy in 1997?
Chipperies? I don't know.
Chipperies? It's just...
It's not called a chippery, and you know that it isn't, and you know it annoys me.
That's true. All of that is true.
Full stop.
Yeah.
It makes my it makes my hair stand on end. Stop saying chippery. I don't know why it makes me so annoying. The English person in me is livid. You may continue talking about K-pop. And the British economy.
I have no idea what was sustaining the British economy in the late 90s.
The good news, because no one does, nothing was. It was shit. There's no industry left. Like, most of the British industry had shut. Agricultural production was actually at its, like, absolute nadir. This is, like, the worst time to be a farmer in British history. And services were declining rapidly, so... Tony had to think on his feet, right? This little goblin man who is a genuinely bad person in his soul and shouldn't be allowed to be speaking in public anymore had to come up with an idea.
I don't know enough about this to co-sign any of this, so I'm just going to say...
He thinks women have to have been biologically born a woman and that we should stop investing in green energy because all of this climate nonsense is too much.
Well, that's not good.
Bad person.
Did he grow up with J.K. Rowling?
Maybe he did. They might have gone to school. They were at Hogwarts together.
Feels like
sure.
A generational issue.
So he came up with a plan that is, ooh, pure bullshit. Amazing bullshit.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out where this turns into K-pop.
Called Creative Britain. That he would build a new part of the economy, a fourth arm of the British economy, based entirely in the creative industries.
I mean, I actually love that conceptually.
Yeah. Hey, what do people love about Britain, Jason?
The Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles. Shakespeare. The Royals. Low walls.
What are the other three pillars of the British economy?
Agriculture, industry, and services.
Okay.
Yeah. So the fourth one is going to be
creativity. I love conceptually the idea of making creativity a pillar of your economy. I see that this is going to go somewhere that's not productive because you never bring up good things, but
I mean, that's the thing, is it could be, but the idea was it was going to be a full-scale development of creative exports.
Great.
And tourism. So it was going to things that we could sell as Britain abroad and things that would bring people to Britain to spend money, right?
Chippers.
Makes a lot of sense. This is when we actually start to see, like, you start doing, like, the tours of Buckingham Palace and all those sorts of things. But this is also when the Spice Girls are going around the world wearing Union flags. And, like, we're getting, like, Guy Ritchie movies released. Trainspotting. Trainspotting comes out in the United States. Like, all the British film and music was being exported. You may very well remember, Jason, seeing on the news that it was the second British invasion. It's like a thing people were saying.
I don't remember people saying that, but I do feel like there was an influx of British acting talent, and I became aware of a lot of British directors. Sure.
Yeah. And so for like five and a half seconds, Britain became this major global cultural creative powerhouse. And then everyone remembered that they were the empire that colonized them in the first place, and that this is an attempt to kind of whitewash Britain's story at the same time, and it didn't sustain itself. The Labour Party actually still campaigns on this to this day. They talk about how creative industries is like worth £125 billion to the British economy, but they also just released the funding for the next year for DCMS, that's the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, £1.6 billion. So they're willing to spend just shy of what, 10? What is that? 2%? 1%, I guess, of the expected value to the economy and actually supporting it. That's why it doesn't work, Jason.
West, I think it's honestly still a bit better than we have here in the U.S. in terms of even like
creating
a governmental system and not trying to dismantle it.
Yeah, but it does not. But if you want to make it like the fourth leg of your economy, you gotta spend money to make money, baby. You can't just say creativity is our economy and then do nothing.
I mean, you can.
You sure can. That's true. Why is this relevant, right?
It's a great question.
It is seemingly unrelated. So we didn't have to go to Britain for a second. If you're in South Korea, you're actually got a very similar situation in some ways. Mid-90s, there was a huge economic crisis in East Asia. We're not going to get into it. Just know that Thailand decoupled its currency from the United States, and it caused huge economic problems everywhere in East Asia. Like every East Asian economy was hit in 1995 and 1996 as a result of this crisis. No worries. South Korea then has a government shift. They have an election in 1997, and the conservative government, who had been in charge since the first elections in South Korea, it had always been the conservative government, they were out, and for the first time, a new center-left party, the National Congress for New Politics, was in charge of South Korea under the presidency of Kim Dae-jung, this is a real thing, known popularly as President DJ. That is really what people call him.
Yeah, I was about to say.
President DJ. I mean, Naomi, you would be the prime minister, DJ, because you don't have a president in the United Kingdom.
Thank you for recognizing me.
So, we've got a center-left party in charge of South Korea. You got a center-left party in charge of Britain. Hey, you even have a center-left presidency in the United States, and it's 1997, so, you know, Slick Willie hasn't been brought up on charges yet. He has indeed engaged in sexual relations in the White House, but he hasn't been caught, which is critical. So there's going to be that looking around to the world and be like, okay, who should I, you know, is there someone I should connect with? And he sees Tony Blair's Creative Britain project and he goes, that's it. We're going to do that. Creative Korea. We're going to make Korea's cultural outputs a critical part of the economy so that we can get away from being too tied into the East Asian sort of export market, right? Most East Asian companies or countries at this time export their goods, raw goods, and that's sort of the backbone of their economy.
And just double checking, this is pretty explicitly because in response to the economic crisis and realizing that if we're too tied into places like Thailand and they decide to do what they did, we're fucked. So let's diversify our portfolio effectively.
Correct. Okay. Yes, that is the logic behind it. Now, they do have one critical problem.
What is their export?
Correct. Nobody knows what the hell Korean culture is, right? Like Britain has an advantage.
Oh, listen, I don't know where this is going, but I do know where it's going. In the sense that the idea that you're like, no one knows what Korean culture is crazy to me, because here in the year of 2025, as I just mentioned, why do I know about K-pop? It's because I went to the Korean barbecue place and I have the Korean the hot dog, like the whatever.
And you had some boba.
Yeah, whatever cultural export scheme is decided, I think I can spoil it by saying it was far more successful in the long term than the British one, because it feels like that is massively different in terms of its cultural understanding.
There's like three new Korean like snack shops open up in the center of Manchester in the last few months.
An incredible cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you get kimchi at Waitrose. There are multiple brands of kimchi at Waitrose. Waitrose is just a grocery store, Jason.
Thank you.
The fancy one. Yeah, it has worked for sure. So how did they make that happen? What was the plan? They had to come up with an idea of what of Korea do people want?
And how do we ship it out?
And how do we ship it out? Brilliant. Yep. So step one, they
put your dick in a box, too.
Yeah, put your dick in a box.
Enough of something completely unrelated.
Do you understand that reference, Naomi?
Nope.
Wow! Hold on. That's a big pause. Dick in a Box is too old for you?
I was like, what the hell is Jason talking about?
I do think that Dick in a Box went about as viral as Psy's Gundam style. It was real big.
It had Justin Timberlake in it.
Yeah, with his dick in a box.
No, I think, no, because that's like 2009.
I was alive. I was obviously
you
wasn't looking at the dick in the box.
You were quite young in 2009.
All right, fair enough. I just made what I thought was a very basic cultural reference. I watched her eyes glaze over, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is important for me.
I was thinking about writing down whether I should cut it or not because I didn't know what it meant.
Step one. President DJ removes all of these restrictions that existed.
Wait, you've never explained. Why is he called President DJ?
Because his last name is Dae Jung.
Oh.
That's it.
Oh, that's fucking... I thought he was a DJ.
No, but I just love that he's called President DJ.
Oh.
I underlined and bolded that in the notes because I was like, I must say President DJ.
Oh, this is so lame. You let me down.
Let me say step one. Step one. President DJ removed a bunch of restrictions that existed on the importation of Japanese cultural products. If you don't know, Japan and Korea, complicated history. There's some occupying and some enslaving that happened.
Just some light occupation.
Yeah. And so Korea, for a long time, just like wouldn't let Japanese stuff come over to South Korea specifically. And so DJ's like, no, let's get rid of that. Let's let that Japanese stuff in. And it's 1997. So what's going on previous episode, Jason? Hello Kitty is starting to blow up because the creator or the person working at Hello Kitty is trying to keep young women from selling themselves into sex work. And so more Japanese products with Hello Kitty are slapped on it. This is also the rise of Pokemon at the same time. So a lot of the Japanese stuff that makes its way to Korea is full-on kawaii.
Yeah, just kawaii.
Which is part of why a lot of the Korean stuff that we associate like has cute animal characters on it. They were like, kawaii. People like that. We're going to run with that. The money made on those imports, right? The taxes and tariffs and things levied on those imports were then spent on the single most aggressive and rapid expansion of internet access any country saw ever. By 2010, Korea, South Korea specifically, obviously, has definitively the fastest like average internet speeds out of any country in the world. And more than 90% of the population is connected to it.
Yes.
So in 13 years.
They are downloading so much of their newly allowed into the country Japanese porn. Just
correct.
Like.
Jason, you're not even wrong. They are 100% doing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Previous episode. So that was the initial 1-2 punch. Let's find out what our wealthy neighbor, Japan, and remember, this is Japan in the 90s, so Japan's still the second largest economy in the world. They're now the fourth, but then they were the second. China hadn't risen to the ranks. And let's make it so that this new internet thing that has emerged, we're able to upload and download things faster than anyone so that we can, when we're ready to launch, shoot our product out into the world at rapid high speeds. Now, that's the mechanism. That's what they want to make. That's how they're going to get it to people. Now they got to figure out how to produce it. And this is where K-pop gets its secret weapon. Every single music studio, film studio, TV studio, and any creative enterprise that is formed in the Republic of Korea must have partial ownership turned over to the Korean government. Usually about 20% or greater.
Really?
And usually in the form of public sector worker pension funds. So if you, this is how I spent my time. If you go look at the major K-pop and K-drama studios and you look into their like their tax filing documents and you go down and look at who are the investors, like who owns it, like there is a secret name somewhere in the mix that when you look into is always like, oh, the waste management workers of Korea's pension fund, or like the doctors of Korea's pension fund. They levy the pension funds the same way that like unions used to like levy pension funds to build the casinos with the mob in Los Angeles.
I don't know about this.
That's the whole, yep. Go watch The Irishman. It's only 3.5 hours long. They talk about it in detail. The Korean government.
I've watched it. I can assure you it clearly did not make enough of an impact.
That's like the whole thing. That's what Al Pacino is doing in
that
movie.
It's a long movie.
It's a long movie. The Korean government is taking the pension fund money of its public sector workers, which they have to contribute to the pension fund. It's a term of their employment, into their cultural outputs so that they have control over what gets produced and how it gets made.
Well, that sounds terrible. I mean, yeah, I misunderstood it first. I thought maybe what they were doing was making sure that anybody working at one of these studios were guaranteed to get their own pension, because then it was somewhat government funded. And so it was actually like a social safety net for artists and creators in case their stuff doesn't turn out successfully. But no, this is specifically so that they can have control and influence of the product. And they're using the arts industry as the stock exchange.
Correct. Yes, they are. They are buying and selling not just the studios, but the artists themselves. If you've ever taken the time to look into it, K-pop bands do not come together by chance. They are not like Seo Taiji.
Yeah,
they
watched a lot of documentaries about that.
Well, that's why I was asking.
Manufactured.
Right, very much like the boy bands in America also. Yes.
But also there's like an element where they've done reality shows and stuff now where they're like, there's actually was came out an article recently about this reality show to become the next pop idol. And it was like really terrible conditions and no one was like eating. And like, yeah they just, they try and like, they monitor everyone's food intake because you've got to be a certain weight to be considered like possible to be a star. And they just train all day, every day. Yeah, it's really bad.
But there's something even worse, because like in America or Britain with this, it's pure capitalism that's running it. Here, it's a combination of capitalism and nationalism and propaganda explicitly.
Correct.
And also the people that are like in these studios that are trying to get these jobs as idols might not actually ever get a job in it. And they spend years starving themselves and training for hours and hours and hours to never get anywhere.
Yeah. Okay. There are thousands of teenagers dropping out of school in Korea to go to these academies where they train to become K-pop idols, and they have to compete against each other. Like, Squid Games is based partially on K-pop, K-idol academies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Obviously taken to the extreme. Obviously, no one's murdering. I don't think... There may be isolated issues, but
there's not systemic murder built in.
There's not systemic murder.
But that is the metaphorical...
There's self-harm.
That's the metaphorical explosion of it, but there are very bad working conditions, etc. Well, and honestly, it sounds like it's bled into, unsurprisingly, our influencer culture now, which is much more decentralized. But I wouldn't be surprised if it has been influenced back by a lot of these kinds of genres to create, sort of through TikTok, the American influencer culture.
Yes. So there is a very planned and devastating to younger generations system that makes the production of K-pop possible, and K-dramas, and even the people who do the animation and draw. Like when you go to like a boba restaurant and it has like a cute character on it, if it's a Korean boba restaurant, it was probably made by someone who was in a similar academy, but with the academy's explicit end goal being you design characters that
illustration
put onto things. Yeah, you are an illustrator. Like, it pervades all of the creative industries, with minimal exceptions in traditional folk creative industries. But even then, there is an emphasis on these cultural exchange programs where, like, Korean folk dancing troupes will go to other countries and those countries will send their cultural attachés, their own, like, dance troupes, for example. And when you see these experiences, the people who come from other countries to Korea, people are like, yeah, we don't really give a shit. We just had to exchange you. Whereas the Koreans are going on putting on a full show. This is Korea. We are incredible.
I thought I was going to be very excited by the fact that you were presenting a government that really was putting value and resources into its arts and culture as a priority. But again, you found a way to make it bad.
It's like a factory that's carbon copying creativity. It's like they actually give each person in the band a personality, and each yes. K-pop band has to have a personality, and then that person has to act as if that's their personality. It's crazy.
Can I throw out a wee silver lining? Part of what President DJ said would be necessary to make this system work was that there was going to need to be a push for more democratic programs and institutions. But President DJ knew Korea had to open up restrictions in society so that creatives could create something worth exporting. So there was, across South Korea, removal of a lot of speech restrictions. So South Korea is a much more free speech country today than it was in the 90s. Expanded suffrage so that more people had the right to vote.
I will say, I know what suffrage means, but I have to point out it's always the weirdest word, because whenever you say we're expanding suffrage, it just sounds like more people will suffer.
Suffering, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Allowed for more political parties, and they removed... So Republic of Korea in the 90s, very centralized system of all the government services. There's more of a decentralizing. Local institutions have more control over some things that are most relevant, things like education and healthcare and what have you. So there is this incredible democratization of South Korea as a direct result of this state-sponsored Creative Korea system, because it was necessary to facilitate people actually being able to work and function in this K-pop manufacturing system in a way that would be appealing.
But also, the opportunity to exert control and the decision to do so are not always the same things. Does the government have the opportunity to control and occasionally pulls those levers, but oftentimes lets people do what they want? Or are they deeply hands-on and restrictive about what material makes its way onto the scene?
From K-pop, the creative industry.
In the creative industry specifically, yeah. Because, like, so, having the opportunity and actually exerting that authority are not always the same thing. It's very tempting to do so when you have it, but you could have the option and then only choose to do it once every 20 years because you're like, no, actually, this is really shitty and this is really meant to be safety, whatever. Or it could be a diabolical thing where they are interfering with art constantly, which is the...
I would argue it's more like the latter than it is in the former.
Of course,
the explicit plan was that so whereas Tony Blair is arguing let's create a fourth pillar of the economy, DJ here is proposing that we create a tool of the state to be deployed as the state needs it. But it is allowed free rein when the state doesn't need it. However, if there's a need, for example, to increase domestic spending in South Korea, if the government says we got to get people shopping and going to restaurants, they make sure that shopping and eating out are featured more in K-dramas, that the music videos being made are about going to the boba place or going to get ramen or going to get whatever. Why did I say ramen? That's Japanese food. They're going to the Korean barbecue, whatever. They're doing that. That's one
thing.
They're
doing implicit subconscious messaging.
Right. If, for example...
Or explicit.
If, for example, the government also, because it uses a foreign weapon as well, it uses it in its foreign relations. If, say, a foreign government threatened the South Korean government with enhanced tariffs on their products, they then make sure that some of these K-idols that they have molded and manufactured speak out publicly on the internet about issues that that government that is trying to pass the tariffs disagrees with. And then what happens is tens of thousands, if not millions, in fact, of K-pop fans joined the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. That was not a natural product of K-pop stars being interested in Black Lives Matter. That was the South Korean government saying to the Trump administration, watch your ass. We will deploy the K-pop army.
And they're a scary army. But you can imagine if you're like a Gen Z person who's getting K-pop all the time, and then your K-pop idols are all saying the same thing about this certain government or this certain movement, it could be very influential.
Naomi, how do we make you an idol?
Oh, too fragile. I'd cry 1 minute into that academy and I'd call my parents up and be like, come pick me up. I want to go home. I don't care.
What a deeply honest response. I was just like, you are our greatest chance to be an influencer.
No. Yeah. I want to drink the boba tea. I don't want to do the training.
I'm ready to be an idol.
Just yeah.
Nobody else is.
Take us home, Andrew.
So yes, it is specifically a tool of the state. Unlike Hollywood, which sort of carried the branding of America and made people think, oh, this is a really great thing to be, or China, which uses its cultural outputs just as an economic flex. Na Zhe, too, made $2 billion this year in box office sales, which now makes it the fifth highest grossing film of all time, and it was released in China and China alone.
I was about to say, I've never heard of that movie.
Correct. It was done on purpose, again, in the face of Trump tariffs. The Chinese plan is to say, we don't need you. So every element of the Korean cultural exports, including the Korean barbecue, is actually baked into this plan. The reason you see more Korean barbecue shops, more boba shops, all of the K-pop bands, the K-drama bands or K-drama shows, which like something silly like 65% of all people who have Netflix in the United States have watched a K-drama. That is a fact that Netflix popped out, is specifically to control your perception of Korea and to feed you a message that the South Korean government is interested in. And it's the only way for a country as small as South Korea to really like fight the fight on the world stage, because they don't have the money of the US or China, and they don't have the military of Russia or the US. This is what they have, and it has become just the way that the Korean government exercises power both domestically but especially abroad. That's why K-pop is everywhere.
Well, I can tell you that in my case, they're doing a great job of feeding me that message, because I fucking love Korean barbecue.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is delicious.
Yeah, they found the way into me. And unsurprisingly, it's through the mouth.
And unsurprisingly, it comes with beef and chili. So that's it. That's the seemingly unrelated. Why is K-pop so popular? Because it's a government-backed, like, PSYOP design. PSYOP? Oh, shit! The clues were there the whole time. Cue.
All right, what did I learn? Well, first off, and I know this is showcases ignorance, but that is my role on the show. I ain't here to showcase ignorance. I'm here to show it's okay to be ignorant if you want to learn to not be ignorant. So I started ignorant, and now I know. Anyways, I had no idea that Psy had like 7 studio albums, and was actually like in on the joke. The way that it was portrayed to me as a young and ignorant American was very much like, this is a goofy novelty thing, very much like Who Let the Dogs Out. And it turns out actually it was incisive self-critique of his own culture that happened to get beyond its intended audience and hit in a very specific way. But I was just like, this is goofy. So apparently it's actually far more well thought out by a seasoned artist and not just some, like, you know, William Hung level, you know, one hit wonder American novelty kind of song. I never knew about the Crazy Frog, and apparently I have to. Who knew? The Crazy Frog.
Absolute belter.
Absolute belter.
Absolute belter.
And then, no, I mean, the fundamental, I did not realize that almost all of Korean cultural export was explicitly a government program designed to infiltrate our countries and change our hearts and minds. And there's parts of that that I actually find pretty smart and interesting, and there's parts of it that found really totalitarian and awful. And it's kind of just what, like, living in the world is, right? Yeah. Like, on the one hand, so many things are like my fundamental thing is, like, is Disney a monopoly that owns everything absolutely awful? Absolutely. Is the fact that they're going to be making X-Men movies better? Yes. You got to take the good with the very bad.
If only there was a way for a country to use government funds and authority to support the arts without exploiting the artists to their core. And
if only.
We've all done it.
If only. Andrew, anything in the research and the preparation for this episode that you want to share in terms of the process over the product?
I got to say, one of the great challenges in putting this episode together was that it's all English language sources, and therefore a lot of the research that I was actually able to do comes from these outside perspectives, and getting... It was hard to get people who were Korean to speak on this situation. It does exist. You can see in the show notes. If you go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/seemingunrelated, the show notes are free for this episode. You can just take a look at them. Tried to get as much raw data from Koreans as possible. And this is a real challenge to consider when we are doing research on cultures and countries which are not our own, which are not something we have that familiarity with, is to try and find those things. And since the whole thing is that the government is trying to use this as a weapon and control the narrative, boy, it was tough as shit to find people who had something to say. And that is why I was straight up looking at tax filings to figure out what level of control the government has over these corporations. It is... bonkers. So just everyone out there, keep that in mind. If you hear anyone speaking of, like, another country or culture and claiming that they have some insights, such as Japan is really living like it's 2050 or whatever, no, they're saying that it's an outside perspective on something that they have no context for.
And it may specifically really be a message that a government is trying to feed to you. But to be fair, we know that that's no different. The U.S. was trying to do that before, as we talked about in our episode about George Plimpton.
Yes.
And when we bring up the plimp, it's time to say adieu. So thank you so much for joining us on this exciting installment of Seemingly Unrelated. If you would like to support the show, there's a few very meaningful ways you can do so. Of course, financially, please go ahead and contribute to our Patreon, where for only $2 a month, you get a bonus episode every single month featuring the cast and some interesting ideas that maybe don't fit into our main episodes. But that's not the only way in this economy that you can support us. You can also help us increase our algorithmic reach by, of course, telling a friend in person, but specifically on Apple Podcast, on Spotify. Please leave a review. Please rate the show. Please share. Please leave a comment. Any way that you interact with this show will help it reach other people, and we deeply appreciate it. We also do have a Substack that you could subscribe to that I will be continuing to write. I've now publicly promised. Everybody, say goodbye.
Bye bye, everybody.
Let's go crazy, frog. Da, 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 da. That's why I just wanted to see us out with that.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone and Jason Howard. Audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zement. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly unrelatedpod.com. Naomi, I went to the artificial intelligence to make a MIDI version of our theme song. Are you ready for it?
I'm scared. Is it good?
Nope.
Okay.
It's not great. It's so much worse than I thought. Perfect. I think we won't be putting that at the start.
No.